Join the conversation.
Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
Okay, it's a bit of a triangle today. I'm in Joburg. Joe, the wingman in Cape Town, ensuring that my voice from Joburg reaches you, and he'll ensure that Dr. Chris Smith's voice reaches you as well. That voice coming all the way from London today. Lecture at the University of Cambridge, and of course our big appointment on a Friday, that appointment with the Naked Scientist. So your questions already plenty in. Welcome, Dr. Chris Smith.
Actually, that triangle just got a little bit more complicated, Clarence, because I'm not in London. I am actually in Cambridge. So it's the Cambridge, Cape Town, Joburg triangle that we're dealing with today. But it's lovely to hear your voice.
For a lot of us South Africans, Cambridge is also London.
Yeah, they're about 80 kilometres apart, so they're pretty close in on African scales. It's sort of literally next door. But believe me, they're a world apart. They're very, very different beasts. Cambridge is kind of a big university with a little city on the side, and London is just a massive city. One of my friends who lives in Joburg, Daniel, calls Cambridge Hogwarts because the buildings look so much like kind of Harry Potter territory.
Interesting. Well, I'll make a turn next time round. I'm due for a visit there. Actually, a whole lot of questions, and I think we're going to go to the WhatsApp line. Joe, take us there.
Hi, good morning. This is John here. About a year or two ago, I phoned in with a question on entropy and, the second law of thermodynamics, and it was explained extremely well and very comprehensively. But I seem to have come up with a few phenomena that are inconsistent with that, and they are air pressure and temperature, both of which tend towards equilibrium. And I think we can all agree that equilibrium tends to be, or certainly is, more stable and organized than the more chaotic of imbalances with the potential energy. So my question is, how do you reconcile this tendency towards equilibrium with the second law of thermodynamics?
Hi, John. Well, first of all, what do we mean by entropy? Well, this was the insight of Boltzmann, who was an incredible chemist / physics / polymath from over 100 years ago, who realized that the nature of the universe is for everything to move towards disorder. So if you want to work out how likely something is to happen, there has to be an increase in entropy, in other words, disorder, as the process occurs, and then it's energetically favourable. That doesn't mean if something doesn't seem to produce a lot of energy and disorder, it won't happen. It means that somewhere else there has to be an increase in entropy to pay for a decrease in entropy in your system. So, for instance, say I make a chemical reaction happen and the temperature actually goes down, which, believe it or not, some chemical reactions are endothermic. You might say, well, that is a reduction in entropy because coldness is less energy, less spreading out, less dissipation of energy. But actually, something else has become more disordered to more than compensate for the drop in temperature, let's say. Now, he's asking, well, if you have air pressure or thermal energy in the environment and it tends towards an equilibrium, is that not a state of order? Well, no, it's not, because what's actually happening, when I reach out and I touch something that is cold, it initially feels cold because there's more energy in my fingertips than there is in the thing I'm touching. But the minute I start to touch it, I start to transfer energy from where there is an abundance of the heat, my fingertips, to where there is less heat in the thing I'm touching. And as I transfer energy at random between the two, some energy is coming back into my fingers, some is leaving my fingers, but the net direction of flow is there's more energy going into the thing rather than coming back. Eventually, you reach a point where there is as much energy being given from my fingers to the thing I'm touching as there is energy coming out of the thing I'm touching back into my fingers. And that is the point of equilibrium. It is an increase in entropy. It is a stable state because things are moving randomly in all directions all the time, back and forth, energy in this instance, and that gives us that balance.
Naked Scientist, this week I saw a notice warning not to use tea bags as the bag is sprayed with a microplastic coating and this is dissolved into your tea, which you consume. Is this true, Abdul, with that question?
Hi, Abdul. Well, the answer is they do treat the paper, because we all think of tea bags as paper, but they're not. If you put them in your compost heap, they'll still be there a year later. The stuff is really hard to break down. And so they do use a range of different substances to make the material, which is not just going to fall apart as paper, to be capable of surviving in your mug of tea while it brews the tea. Unfortunately, they over-engineer the system and it survives much longer. Whether it's imparting microplastics to your tea, I don't know if it sheds lots of microplastics. I haven't seen the data on that. Interesting question. I will have a look at that and see what is on the tea bag and how much of that is judged to be entering the tea. But you are absolutely right that these are not just standard bits of paper and they don't rot down like paper does.
Liz is on the line. Welcome, Liz. Go ahead for the Naked Scientist.
Morning. Somebody asked me the other day, where does all the water on the planet come from? I didn't know, so I'm asking you, Dr. Chris.
Hi, Liz. Well, a number of sources. One is that when the planet first formed, in the material, there was a lot of gas and dust that formed around the young sun that slowly accreted and coalesced to form the Earth. There was water, but nothing like the amount we have now. And we agree that the vast majority has come from space and impacts from comets and also asteroids brought the water here, most of it arriving in the first billion years or so of the Earth's existence. The evidence we have for that is that water, H2O, has a particular chemical fingerprint, a so-called isotope profile, which enables us to compare our water with the water that we find or can see out there on asteroids and comets and so on. And when we compare that isotope profile, we find it's very similar from asteroids, but also some comets. And therefore, it supports our theory that most of the water, but not all, arrived here after the planet formed from comet and asteroid impacts. And it added a few inches every million years or so to the planet, adding up to the huge depth of many kilometres of oceans that we now have covering 75% of the Earth's surface.
Then we got a voice note. Joe, take us there.
Good morning, Clarence and Dr. Smith. Quick question. I had to put my dog down last year, and obviously they put him to sleep. What actually happens? And could the same be done to humans? And from what I understand, it's the same thing, anesthetic, but you kind of overdose on it. So does the same apply to humans if you had to do it? Just curious. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry about the poor old pooch. The answer to this is yes, and we could do the same thing with a person. We put animals to sleep when we judge that their quality of life and their suffering is incompatible with keeping them alive. And we aim to humanely dispatch them by giving them a dose of... There's a range of different chemicals that you can use. These are painless to inject, and they usually work by going in through a vein up to the brain, and in the brain these chemicals strongly activate the inhibitory nerve systems and deactivate, therefore, the excitatory systems, which leads to a shutdown in your brain. And specifically, it shuts down the parts of the brain that make us breathe and maintain our blood pressure and heart rate. And so you basically go into a very deep sleep that you don't even know you're in to start with, and then you go into a state where you just stop breathing and then your heart stops. And so this is not painful. It's very, very calm, gentle way to slip away. And it is no different than when a person goes to the hospital and the anaesthetist puts them to sleep. The anaesthetist is doing the same thing, but in a much more controlled way and making sure that the patient doesn't stop breathing, doesn't have a cardiac arrest. So the anaesthetist is controlling that state to make sure that the person is kept unconscious but can be reversed out of their unconsciousness. If the anaesthetist were to go further, that person could just slip away in the same way as we do with animals when we euthanize them. Yeah.
That's another ding-dong moment. Thank you for that question. Thank you for that answer, mostly. Naked Scientist Chris Smith, I read a paragraph with plus-minus 30 sentences. All the vowels were taken out, but I still could read all the sentences without fail. How is that possible? Thanks, Keith.
Yeah, I know. I've done this, and it's extraordinary when you see what looks like gobbledygook, and then you look a bit more closely, and you think, I can actually understand this. If I just remove all the vowels from the words, this is because our brains do not decode words in terms of the string of letters like we decode DNA, where each letter counts. Our brains chunk the words into bits and then look at the pattern. And this means that even if a bit of the word is wrong, it can still spot the pattern and link them all together and decode the word. And we do this all the time. Our brains fill in gaps for us all the time to help us to spot these sorts of patterns. And this means that even if someone's got shoddy handwriting or they've spelled a word wrong, you can still understand it. A computer, unless it's been programmed to avoid this sort of thing, it would trip over that straight away. If you had a mutation in your DNA, your body would immediately make the wrong thing. But our brains are really good because they're working in chunks of letters rather than individual letter-by-letter recognitions, and they're filling in the gaps. We can get around that. And it's part and parcel of how your brain does this for every aspect of psychology. It's how you're going through life. Your brain is inventing loads of stuff and removing loads of stuff that's not being presented to your consciousness to give you the experience you're having. And it's how we manage to operate the way we do as quickly as we do without getting cognitive overload. And we sometimes only see this happening when we do experiments like that, and it reveals the amazing workings of our nervous system to us.
I'm wondering if this isn't maybe Waleed asking for a friend. That's a nudge, nudge, wink, wink. But it reads, Dr. Chris, how do hair implants work? I'm considering it, but not really sure how it works.
When we have a hair transplant, what we're doing usually is combating natural hair loss. This is more common in men than women, although not exclusively so. Some women do inevitably suffer some hair thinning as they get older, but most of the candidates for hair transplant are males, and that's because we are at higher risk of male pattern baldness. This is a genetic condition that renders the hair follicles on certain parts of the body, chiefly your head, and in a very specific pattern, sensitive to testosterone. And for various reasons, the testosterone is metabolized into a form that kills those vulnerable hair follicles. That also means there are some hair follicles that are not killed in that way. And these are usually at the back of the head and the sides of the head. So when we have a hair transplant, what a hair transplant surgeon will do is to effectively take a punch biopsy of a bit of your head thousands of times to harvest the patch of scalp which contains an intact hair follicle, which is a little ring of stem cells which make the hair filament, because hair is a protein called keratin, which is assembled in a sort of plait by this ring of stem cells. So if you pull out the follicle, which is this ring of stem cells, intact, you can then implant it back into another patch of the scalp, and it will make the hair there instead of where it originally came from. And so by taking the hair follicles from the parts of the scalp where you do not have this sensitivity to testosterone, they're resistant, and we don't exactly know why this is, you can transplant them to places where there is less hair and you're at risk of losing more hair, and they will make sure you continue to produce hair in those regions, and in that way you maintain better coverage.
Plenty of questions in via the WhatsApp line. Let's go to a voice note, Joe.
Actually, in Cambridge.
Hi, Professor. How do Haridas know where to pick their nose, or beaks, where the worms are?
I think the question was, how does a bird know where the worms are? Well, birds don't, but they do have amazing vision. Birds have got really good eyesight, much more acute in some cases than our own. They could pass the eye test at 20 metres when we're at 6 metres. They have incredible powers of observation. So A, they can see things that we just can't see. They can also see movement very, very, very well. And they also take advantage of the fact that when it rains, the rain comes down on the ground, fills up the worm burrows, and it pushes the worms up towards the surface. So birds will also be attuned to that. They'll also watch what we do. And if we go and dig the ground, disturb the ground, if a farmer tills the ground, they also know that usually this unearths worms. And so they'll come down and poke around in recently disturbed soil because they know that's also a good place to find worms. So really, A, they're intelligent, B, they have excellent vision, and C, they're hungry.
Take another one, Joe.
Hi, good morning, Clarence, and Dr. Chris Smith. It's Jason here from Brackenfell. I just want to know, how do birds see
like, what do they see? Is it like a proper fish eye? Do they see the beak and the tail? And does the same apply to a fish? I'm just curious. Thanks again, guys, for a great show.
Fish and well, the eye, let's start there. The eye has evolved numerous times in nature. And in some cases, the eyes are like insect eyes. They're compound eyes. And this is like an eye that's got lots of eyes making up the eye. And these individual eyes all focus down onto or send nerve signals down onto a nerve structure that enables the fly to build an image of the world around it from lots of little eyes. Whereas we have eyes that focus light onto a light-sensitive sheet, the retina, and we build a picture by comparing input from both eyes and then mapping that onto our brain, where there's a map of the eyes in the brain, and those eyes activate those different bits of that map, and we build a picture of the world that way. Birds have a very similar eye to us, except that their retina is a slightly different shape, which enables them to pack in more photoreceptors, the rods and cones, and also arrange them in such a way that they have some patches of their vision where they have incredible acuity and other regions where they're very good at spotting movement coming in from the side so they can take avoiding action. Then sea creatures like cuttlefish and octopus also have incredible vision, but their eyes have evolved to be probably a bit more like ours compared to an insect, for example. So the eye has evolved numerous times. It works in similar ways across many different parts of life, but there are also different ways of making eyes and making them work. When a bird sees, it sees very similar to how we see. And we know this because people have done various psychological and neuroscientific experiments on birds' brains. Birds look at faces. They recognize each other. They recognize us. They also can recognize when they're being looked at and where other things are looking. There's really good evidence for the fact these birds know when they're being watched, for example, because they can look at where another bird is looking and work out if that bird is looking at them. So they pay a lot of attention to eyes, eye position and eye movements. And this is because some birds hide food for themselves to come back to later. And they will do an interesting behavior, which is when they hide this food, they look around. And if they see another bird in the vicinity that's watching them, they'll come back later and move the food because they anticipate that it is going to get stolen by that other bird. So therefore, they must be using and processing vision in a very similar way and thinking along the same lines that we do. And their eyes work very similar to ours, so they therefore probably see in a very similar way to us. One exception to this in terms of how they actually control their eyes is the birds like pigeons. When they're walking around on the ground, you'll notice that they bob their head. It goes forward and back with each step of the pigeon. But when they're flying, they don't do that. And the reason that they do that is because they have eyes on the backs of their heads compared with, say, a hawk, where the eyes are focused towards the front more. And by having eyes on the sides of the head, if they were to allow their head to just stay fixed in one position as they walked along, the world would stream past their head on both sides and be quite distorted and difficult for them to interpret. So what they do is move their head forward, fixate on the environment, and then move their body under their neck, moving their neck back as they move to keep their head fixed in space so that they get the clearest picture of the world. So they've evolved that for when they're walking around on the ground to make most sense of what they see.
Let's see if we can help Colleen out. Colleen says, I have a heavy head cold. Why are my eyes streaming tears?
Hi, Colleen. The reason that we cry when we have a bad cold is chiefly because most colds are caused by viruses, and most viruses infect the linings of the nose. That's how we get them into us, but also the virus centers on the nose because it's a route out of the body to infect other people. It irritates the lining of your nose, makes you sneeze, and then you spray out a cloud of virus particles, which other people then breathe in, and they're infected. That's how things spread. When the viruses infect the lining of the nose, they cause inflammation. What that does is increase the blood flow to the tissue, making it swell because there's more blood in the tissue. And if there's more blood in the tissue taking up space, there's less space for air to go through. So you get a stuffed up nose sensation. We all think that's because of loads of mucus. There is mucus, but a lot of the congestion is the swelling of the airways. Now, because your eyes drain their tears, which are produced by your lacrimal gland on the upper outer part of your head, and puts the tears into the eyes, which then drain across the eye and down to the lower inner edge of your eyelid, and they then go into your nasolacrimal duct, which drains into your nose. And if you have a stuffed up nose and swelling, it squeezes in on the lacrimal duct and it stops the tears flowing quite so quickly down into your nose, and therefore they tend to well up in your eyes, and this makes your eyes water.
We're going to have to rest it there. Big thank you, Dr. Chris Smith, lecturer at the University of Cambridge, the naked scientist. Colleen, I hope you get well really soon.